Welcome, everyone. You're tuning in to the Beyond the Pulse podcast, brought to you by the expert doctors at My Cardiologist, where we discuss a wide range of topics related to cardiovascular wellness and provide you with the knowledge, motivation, tips, and tools to help you make informed choices about your heart health. My Cardiologist is proud to be a leading provider of comprehensive cardiovascular care, serving the South Florida community for over 60 years. And we're thrilled to extend our care beyond the clinic through this podcast. Thank you for joining us.
My name is Michael Grillo. I'm a cardiologist. I practice here in South Florida. I like to practice preventive medicine, and that's what we're here to discuss.
Today's episode's all about the health heart spectrum, preventative healthcare versus reactive healthcare. So, Doc, thank you for being here today. I'm super excited to talk to you because we've had a lot of cardiologists on that deal in more of the reactive or the, you know, you're aging, it's about time to get a checkup. Well, you're focused more on the preventative end. So what's the difference between the preventative healthcare versus the reactive?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think it's a very important topic since for the past 20, 40 plus years, we've been more reactive. Now the medicine is changing to be a more proactive, right, to prevent cardiovascular diseases and events, right? So when it comes to prevention, right, we have to be more conscientious about our health on a daily basis, right? And it's very difficult to do nowadays because of, you know, we live a very busy lifestyle, right? Everybody's very busy at work, right? So the last thing that people would think is, okay, how's my health today, right? And so it's very important that we address this with the patients on a daily basis. This is how I like to present to the patients, discuss with the patient. Think about, an analogy is think about your body like a car, right? You take your car for regular checkup, maintenance, right? For oil change. And why do we do that? Well, we don't want to be stranded in the street, right?
Right.
Because then we have to be reactive and we have to go call AAA, right? So think about your body that way. And so you have to go to the doctor and go for regular checkups. So your cardiologist or your primary doctor can assess what's your risk of having cardiovascular events, right? And once that risk is assessed, then we can take the necessary measures to reduce that risk.
I see. So yeah, that's a great analogy because I feel like a lot of people might even take care of their cars a little bit better than they take care of their own selves.
Well, some would say yes.
So why is it important that somebody understands where they fall on this health heart spectrum?
Yeah, and the reason why is because before we can do any intervention, we need to know where we're starting,
okay,
right? This is a way for us to measure the cardiologists or primary doctors to measure the risk versus benefits, right? So we first assess, okay, the risk of this person is whatever percentage, 7%. 10%, 15%, 20% risk of having a cardiovascular event in a 10-year period, right? So once we have that number, okay, now we think of what interventions would reduce that risk the most, right, versus the risk of those intervention, right? So it's very important to first assess the risk. And so then we can discuss with the patient further about the risk and benefits of any intervention.
Okay. And so what factors do you see in your practice are the main contributors to this, and how can we prevent them?
So contributors to any cardiovascular event are the main risk factors that we've seen nowadays, that we're seeing, especially after COVID, right? It is the sedentary lifestyle, okay? Because of the lockdowns, right, more people were at home, right? They couldn't go to the gym. Their entire lifestyle changed completely. And so one of the very common problems that I see on a daily basis is the patient now got used to that sedentary lifestyle. To change it has become very difficult, right? Go back to the gym or start exercising, right? To break that pattern has been challenging, to say the least, yes. Apart from that, you have that involves into having high blood pressure, right? High cholesterol, but it's all in within the same circle of if you don't work out, then your blood pressure goes up. Your BMI, your body mass index goes up, right? You gain some pounds. And so it's all interchange within each other. So I think it's important to target these patients of, try to change their lifestyle or help them. I think the better way is to educate them, right? By telling them that, hey, your risk is either very high and it's important to make these changes so we can reduce those risks as much as possible.
Okay. So yeah, I feel like a lot of people have a good understanding of that they should be exercising, they should walk, but maybe along certain other lifestyle changes, they might not be so certain on what to do, such as maybe a diet or what to eat. I would love to get into it with you as far as what are some heart-healthy foods and what are some foods that we should avoid? Because I hear about sodium a lot, and I have no idea what I'm doing.
Yeah, and you know, we can sit here and talk a whole day about the diet, okay. Right? Because if you we live in the internet era, right, where you have so much information out there, and different social media influencers provide different diets, right? Recommend right. different diets. And it's worth noting that the internet and social media influencers influence the patients a lot more than the doctors do. Why? Because they have more, they provide more content out there, right? When a patient comes to the office once every so often, right? And we only talk to the patient 15 minutes.
Sure.
Versus an influencer is out there putting content, right, on a daily basis, right? So it's very important as a patient, right, to understand, and not just understand, but digest that information, right?
Okay.
So what I would say is, there are a lot of diets, and I'll mention some. Mediterranean diet, DASH diet, which is very important for blood pressure, intermittent fasting, right? They're all good. It's not one specific, right? It all depends on the patient's lifestyle, the patient's overall condition, right? And so what I would say is that as a person, if you're listening to your influencer and they mention something online, right, get that information and share with your cardiologist or your doctor and say and ask, is this a good diet for me?
Right? Oh, that's a good
Because again, the influencers are, telling you diet that could be good, but they don't know your health information. They don't know whether that is a good diet for you, right? So again, I'm not saying that you should listen to this person over that person. I'm just saying gather all that data, that information, write it down, get some other references, and speak to your doctor about it to see whether that's the best approach for you.
I like that. I haven't ever thought about taking some online stuff and taking it to my doctor and kind of fact-checking that. Do you think that the type of diet that a person goes on is mostly the condition of the patient, or does it kind of differ from person to person depending on just maybe their biological makeup?
Yeah, and so, the kind of medicine I like to practice is personalized medicine.
Okay.
Right? Not every person is the same. They have different condition. Not just that, they have different lifestyle, right? Some patients work at night and sleep during the day, right? So it's very difficult to tell certain people that intermittent fasting is good for them, right? And so to answer your question, yes to both. Their condition, but also their lifestyle requires different approach to determine which diet is best for them. And this is where shared decision, right, comes into play, where not one person makes a decision, not one influencer influences on this person, but the influencer, the patient, and the physician make a shared decision for the better of the patient's health, of course.
Oh, okay. So what are some common misconceptions when it comes to heart health?
Yeah, this is a great question because I see this on a daily basis, I would say. You know, most conditions, I wouldn't say most conditions, but most conditions that I see in the office on a day-to-day basis are asymptomatic, meaning that patients don't feel it. Mm. And those are high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol, right? Stress, insomnia, difficulty sleeping. These are conditions that patients, most patients don't feel, right? And so because they don't feel it, then it's difficult to tell them or ask them that something needs to be done to target those conditions. Because why? Well, if it's not interfering with their day-to-day activity, they're thinking mostly about their work, about, you know, their day-to-day, right, busy schedule,
sure,
right? So it's very difficult to change somebody's thinking, right? If it doesn't impact their day-to-day life. These conditions, when they do impact their life, unfortunately, that's when we transition from being proactive to reactive, right? And that is very, very important to differentiate, right? Because these are conditions that cause cardiovascular events like strokes, heart attacks, heart failure, right? Conditions that impact on your quality of life as well as your longevity, right? Before being reactive, proactive, I believe, is the new medicine, is the modern medicine.
Sure.
And that's what I like to practice.
I see. So a lot of the misconceptions maybe just come from a lack of feeling any symptom. And so they think they're okay.
Yep.
And they don't start to be active,
right,
in their own health until an event takes place. And then at that point, they're already past the stage of being proactive. They're now reactive.
Exactly right. And that's why it's so much easier to explain and for a patient to say yes when the patient is in the hospital,
right,
with an event. Why? Because that event interfered with that person's lifestyle. Mm. All of a sudden, they're not at work. They're in the hospital. You know, and they're in the hospital because they have a problem that they want you to take care of right away so they can go back to their busy schedule, right? So they're more acceptable, they're more perceptive,
sure,
of your recommendation in the hospital. But when you're in the office, when they come to the office, they feel good, even though they have high blood pressure or they have obesity. Oh, they have all these other risk factors, right? It's more challenging to the risk of having cardiovascular event.
I could imagine. And I could also imagine a lot of patients, they don't want to go through some traumatic event in order to wake up. What have you found to be some of the most effective ways that you've been able to request from your patient that they take a proactive approach where they actually go and then do it?
Yeah. And one approach I do is, you know, I found that when you show the patient evidence of their high risk one of the typical consultations you do in the office is a patient comes to you for the first time. Hey doc, I'm here to get a checkup, right? And you show that you do all these tests and then you show them, oh, your cholesterol is a little bit elevated, your blood pressure is elevated, this and that. But these are things that they don't feel, right?
Right.
And these are data, these are levels that, oh, my cholesterol is high, okay, whatever. But there are certain tests that you can do that are relatively newer that shows them that, for example, a coronary calcium score is a test that we've been using for the past 10 years or so, mm-hmm, which shows the patient how calcified the arteries are, which is correlated with the risk of having any major cardiovascular events, right? And so doing tests, heart evidence, to show them where they are in the risk category, unfortunately, the higher the risk, the more impact it has on the patient to change their lifestyle.
Sure.
Right. So it may not, the workup may not change a patient's lifestyle if their risk is low or even intermediate. But if the risk is very high, right, I've seen it, you know, that it does impact on their lifestyle, yes.
Have you noticed patients that get their tests back, they are very low risk that they maybe want to go out and start eating however they want, just kind of doing whatever they want at that point?
Yes. So I have seen it. That's where it has a double-edged sword, right?
Right.
Where if you do the test and the risk tends to be low, right? If it's very low, the risk of having cardiovascular event, then the question is, how is that information going to impact on the patient lifestyle?
Right.
Right. And yes, I've had personally seen patients who you tell them, you know, your risk is low.
Get empowered to live.
And then they take that information and, you know, it affects their way of thinking. Well, if I've lived my life so far to now and my risk is low, you know, I'm going to either continue doing what I'm doing or even worse, you know, it's important to note, you know, that those risks are short-term risks.
Oh.
The risk, they change as you get older, right? So it's very important to know that even if your doctor tells you that your risk is low, in a few years from there, your risk may change. And that's why it's very important to follow up and have regular checkups with your physician. And going back to my first analogy, just like a car, right? You change the oil, but you got to continue changing the oil, right? So the engine doesn't stop running.
Right. And if you, let's say you have a supercar, super nice car, you don't want to start putting in the lowest tier gas because right. just because, you know, you got to check up on the car and then said the car's doing fine.
That's right.
You
That's
have to
right.
keep it up.
That's exactly right. And so I would, you know, again, if your physician tells you that your risk is low or even intermediate, it doesn't mean that your risk will be low forever.
Right.
It's a short term risk.
How
10
short
years.
Term? Oh, okay.
10 years. But again, we see patients from 30 years old, 40 years old, that, you know, they get older. And as they get older, their risk goes up, right? So it's important to continue having a regular checkup with your doctor.
So, doctor, we just kind of talked about your most effective approach that you've seen in your practice is showing them some test results and going, hey, look, it's not looking good. And that usually gets them on the path to be a little bit more proactive. Are there any additional resources and support that you found that help people get a little bit more on the proactive side?
Yeah. You know, nowadays, since we live in the internet, online, you know, it's very important the people that you follow, right? And so you should spend a lot of time finding people's backgrounds, right? If you're going to choose somebody to listen for your health and follow their advice, right, you should definitely look up their background, make sure, you know, they have the adequate background to give those kind of information. And I like to follow people who post their references, the links to the references, right? I think it's a great way to show some validity to what you're saying, okay? But also, your biggest resource should be your doctor, right? Somebody who you can have a conversation and discuss about whatever you've read. Because, and this is something that I've encountered and I've experienced myself, is that you can show the same data to the 10 different people, and you will have 10 different interpretations to the data, right? So it's very difficult to analyze the data if you haven't been trained to do so, right? So to pinpoint a specific resource online, it's hard to do, because I could tell you, go ahead and read this specific paper on diet, and your interpretation to that data will be maybe different from what the conclusion of the data was.
That's so interesting. So it's not just being on high alert for fake news or fake information. It's being able to interpret it correctly or following somebody who's interpreting it correctly and can put it into a layman's language that you understand.
That's correct.
Wow.
And so that's why I wouldn't just follow one person. You know, I would follow different people with maybe different opinions, right? But also that have the references linked, right? They're linked to the references available for you to look at the data for yourself, make your own interpretation, but you also want to discuss with your doctor, and that's how you make a shared decision, right? I know it's difficult to do that because people have busy schedule, you know, but if you are considering changing your lifestyle based on somebody's recommendation, I think it's prudent to spend some time analyzing that data and making your own conclusion.
So you're saying to be a little bit more proactive, to find the influencers who are giving you proper information and providing the materials for you to rate on your own, and then even going a step further and taking it to your doctor and being like, hey, is this guy, you know, legit? Do you have any influencers in mind that are
There's a few that I, you know, I personally use Twitter mostly, right? But other people may use Instagram, and I know Gen Z uses more
TikTok.
Thanks for it's hard to keep up with the new trends, you know. But no matter which social media you use, I think it's important to, again, get their background and make sure that the background aligns with what they're suggesting or recommending.
Sure.
Right. My point here is that, and I've seen this on my practice, is that when you empower the patient, right, to make the decisions for themselves with the physician, right, you get more long-term results. Right. It's easier for me to tell the patient, you know, follow this, this, and this. Right. It's easier. But I've come to learn that it doesn't last long. Right. When you compare it to the patient themselves feeling empowered. Right. Analyzing the data. Listening to what you have to say. Right. Going to other sources and confirming that data. Then you have better long-term results, right? So in conclusion, as a person, as a patient, you should feel empowered, okay? And I think one of the best things you could do is, again, read the underlying data, right? Talk to different professionals within that field and come up with a conclusion that could better your health care.
Awesome. Yeah, I think that's right on. Are there any case studies or success stories that demonstrate the benefits of preventative healthcare? And then after this, we can kind of get into talking a little bit on the more reactive.
Yeah. So, you know, those are a little bit hard to prove since the people who follow preventive, right? Their risk of going being in the hospital and getting treatment, it's much less.
Right.
Now, the studies have shown over and over again, depending on which intervention you do, and this is something that you can discuss, patients can discuss with their physicians as to which medication, which diet, which exercise has the best success at doing some sort of intervention to reduce your risk. But again, it depends on, it's an individual by individual case, right? But again, there are different interventions that produce good results, but it all depends on a case by case person. Now, I wanted to go by with the reactive, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, absolutely.
When we go to the other side of the coin and now we are being reactive, is because some event occurred, mm-hmm. right, on this person's life. To start off with stroke, which is a very, very debilitating condition, there's an acronym that I was taught when I was in school, and I use it still nowadays, is FAST. And the F is for face, right? If you or a family member of yours, you recognize a drooping of one side of the face, that's a red alert right there, okay? The A is for weakness of one of the limbs, arms or legs, right? Of one side of the body. The S is for speech. If you or a family member has difficulty expressing themselves or getting the word out, that's another sign as well. And the T is very important. And this is something I would like to emphasize to people listening to this, is time. There's a saying in medicine that time is tissue. Why? Because the longer this tissue go without oxygen, the higher the risk of that tissue being dead, dying, and becoming irreversible.
A tissue dying, it's just blood not getting to the tissue. Is that my understanding?
Well,
is that
right? Good question. And so not because, when you cut the blood supply to that tissue, there's a time where if you can revascularize, if you can open the blood flow again, the tissue can recover. Mm. But the longer it takes, specifically for the brain, about 4 hours, right, is how long you have for that tissue to recover again. If it's much more than that, then the probability of that tissue recovering is very, very low. Mm. And that's where that person tends to have long-term debilitating weakness or speech impairment, right? So that's why it's very important for whoever's recognizing, or if you're the person who's experiencing those symptoms, to seek medical attention immediately. Because once you get medical attention, once you start having the symptoms, the time starts going, right? And so you have a very short window for the medical provider to provide any treatment, any intervention that could restart the blood flow to that tissue that is already dying.
Now, when you say limited time, you're talking like hours?
Hours.
Okay, so it's like go to the ER.
That's exactly right.
Wow.
Either go to the ER right away. If you can't drive, because you're the person, then call 911 immediately.
Really?
Yes.
Is that critical?
Is that critical? Where actually in certain cities, they have ambulances where they have a CAT scan, a CT scan in the ambulance.
No way.
To image the brain and come up with a plan even before the patient reaches the emergency room.
Okay, so you have the FAST acronym, FACE, ARMS, speech and time or tissue.
Or tissue, right.
And so that's for a stroke. And that's pretty much like, if my understanding is correct, it's a heart attack in the brain.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
That's
exactly right. And so what are some symptoms of a heart attack for your heart?
Right. And so just like I explained about the brain, the same thing can happen in the heart.
Really?
Where there's an acute blockage of the blood flow to the heart muscle. Right. And so when that occurs, the symptoms are very different from a stroke in the brain. Typically, the most common sign is chest pain, where you have chest discomfort. And again, this varies from person to person. Right. But some of the signs and symptoms are chest pain, back pain, shortness of breath. Right.
Really?
Also, abdominal pain, right? And unfortunately, women tend to have more of the atypical symptoms than men. Mm. That is why women's heart attacks are misdiagnosed the most.
I see. So they could feel in the abdomen, the back, something that the doctor's like, it's something else.
And I've personally seen it, actually, where women go to the ER, right? And nobody thinks of a heart attack at an earlier stage on women, because they may come in with abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, symptoms that don't spike, don't give you that red flag, oh, that person is having a heart attack.
Because it's more common for like a menstrual cycle or something, right?
Exactly. And so, you know, as opposed to a man, men typically have more chest pain, right?
Is it always over the heart, or can it be on the other side too?
It could be on the other side as well.
Yeah. Whoa, yep. I did not know that.
Yep. And so it's very important to recognize this if you're the patient, or if it's a family member of yours who's complaining of any of these symptoms, to seek medical attention right away. Mm-hmm. It could be an urgent care. It could be an emergency. Anything where they can do an EKG. They can do some basic workup. Fortunately, is that compared to the brain, where person is having a stroke, unfortunately, they need to go to the emergency room, because that is where most of the equipment is, right? That is a CAT scan or these advanced imaging modalities.
Sure.
With a heart, if a person is having a heart attack, something as simple as an EKG, which is available even in our offices, right? That can be done. And we can detect right away if someone is having a heart attack. Now, the problem with this is that EKGs also can miss them. And that's where you need to do a little more, not invasive, but extra work, including a blood test.
Okay. So how quickly do they have to do this? I mean, you said with the stroke within a couple hours.
Yep.
Is it the same thing?
So to some point, yes.
Okay.
It really depends on how severe that artery is blocked. If it's 100% blockage, then yes, you have hours, but you have more time than a stroke.
Okay.
Right? However, it's still the same principle of time is tissue applies to the heart. Mm. And so my advice is to always seek medical attention immediately, as soon as after you started having the symptoms. Because why? The sooner you open that blockage, the risk of having long-term consequences and like heart failure, that risk reduces, right? And nowadays, compared to 15, 20 years ago, where more people were dying of heart attacks, now more people are surviving the heart attacks. However, more people are living with long-term consequence of those heart attacks, including heart failure, right? Mm. So
what's the difference between a heart attack and heart failure?
Very good question, yeah. So heart failure is the inability of the heart to pump oxygen throughout your body. Oh. And you need medications to help the heart pump more oxygen, right? And that is a topic of its own.
Okay.
But the importance here is that heart failure is a long-term consequence. It's a long-term complication that interferes with the quality of life of the patient, as well as with the longevity and increased mortality of the patient. So in conclusion, so people can understand, a heart attack is a sudden blocked artery, a sudden block of the blood flow to the tissue, right? The sooner you open that artery, the better the prognosis, and you reduce the long-term effect of that heart attack. If you wait too long and you develop heart failure, that impacts your quality of life, and that impacts your longevity and, you know, increases your mortality.
If I'm understanding you correctly, let's say somebody, a patient of yours, has a cardiac event, they have a heart attack, mm-hmm. they come to you, you do some, like put in a stent or something,
mm-hmm.
they now realize they need to start taking the precautions. You put them on a plan. Is it possible to reverse what's already been done?
Yeah, good question. So your risk from there on, so when the event occurred, right, forward, now we're talking about secondary prevention, right? It's a different scope because you will always be at risk of having another heart attack, right? So now your risk is much higher than those or even yourself prior to the heart attack, right? So you will always have a high risk. Now your entire lifestyle changes, you know, and that is if everything went by the book and we were able to restore the blood flow to the tissues before they had any permanent sequela, right? Let's say everything went well and we put a stent there and we opened the artery well, you will always be at risk of having another one. And so that's where in those type of patients, the intervention has better results in terms of reducing the risk even better than patients who have low risk or even intermediate risk of having a heart attack, right? Where diet, exercise has more of an impact on these patients of having another heart attack compared to those who never had a heart attack in the first place, right? So their approach is a little bit more different. It's different because I'm stricter with those patients, right? Why? Because they will always live with a higher risk of having any cardiovascular events.
That's very intriguing. So you can never go back to being like, all right, I'm going to now practice preventative health after the event's already occurred. You're too late. Now you're in the reactive state. But what you've noticed with your own patients is those people tend to be a little bit better as far as the lifestyle goes because of the event.
Yes and no.
Really? Okay.
So yes, because, you know, we're humans and we tend to have short-term memory. Okay. So yes, that, you know, they will change their lifestyle 5, 10 years, right? But what about 20 years from now, right? If they've lived the first 10 years after the heart attack, doing everything by the book, everything well, they feel great. 20 years, you know, they probably forgot about the heart attack, how they felt, right? Especially if there weren't any long-term sequela from the first heart attack. So they may pick up a cigarette, right? The longer the person lives, right, the higher the chances of that person being influenced with bad habits.
I see.
Right? So that is where we go back to the regular checkups with your physician, right? Being self-conscious about your health, right? And so to answer your question, yes, to the short term, and may not be the case in a long term.
In your opinion, what's a regular checkup? What time?
Good question. And it really depends in case by case. It depends on the risk of the patient. The higher the risk of the patient, the frequent the checkups, right? So to give you some examples, a 30-year-old person who has no risk factors, right? They go to the gym, they take care of themselves, low risk, right? They may not even need a cardiologist, just a primary doctor, right? And there are certain things that they can do themselves at home, checking their blood pressure regularly, right? And so with some annual visit with the doctor to do just blood tests, that's enough. Now, when you see the other side of the spectrum, patients who have very high risk, right? Those are the type of patients that you want them to follow up with a cardiologist and see them maybe every 6 months, right? To have an EKG, check their blood pressure, make sure their lifestyle continues to be preventative, proactive, right? Mm-hmm. Making sure you're, you know, having any discussion, if the patient has any doubts or stop taking the medications, right? You want to intervene in that early rather than later.
I see. So doing all these tests, it's almost, yes, to get your score and to know where you're at, but it's kind of inspirational to them because they'll be able to see, oh man, I got better or I got worse. I got to change this. I got to do that. I got to continue doing this.
That's right. It's like when you go to the gym, right? And you try to go to the gym to lose weight. You know, you get on the weight scale every so often to make sure you keep track of your progress, right? Mm. You same applies here. You go to the doctor, make sure that you're following the right trajectory, right? Because like I said in the beginning, most of these risk factors, patients are asymptomatic. They don't feel it. So how would they know they are in the right path if we don't do these measures, right? So that's where the regular checkup with the physician is very important.
Yeah, I think I'm having ghost chest pain.
I was about to stop. Are you okay? You know.
So yeah, I mean, if I had momentary, let's say a 5 minute, my chest kind of hurts a little bit. Is that something to be worried about? How long does it have to be before I'd be like, all right, there's something going on here?
Yeah, that's a good question, especially because ever since I spoke about this topic, I see you touching your chest. And,
I'm having like ghost chest.
I want to make sure you're okay, right?
I think I'm okay, yeah. All
right. No, so that's a good question, especially since the most common symptom for which patients come to the emergency room is actually chest pain, right? So you can see that you have an influx of patients coming to the ER, saturating the low staff in the ER to begin with, right? And the majority of those chest pain are benign, right? They tend to be musculoskeletal or even stomach pain, right? And how can you differentiate one from the other is very hard to do, especially for someone who's having the pain and doesn't have an idea of, is this pain real or not? So my advice is that if you have a chest pain that it happened all of a sudden, right, you are someone who've never had chest pain and it happens and is severe, seek medical attention immediately. Do not wait. It's always better be safe than sorry. Okay? Mm-hmm. So again, if you're someone who's never had chest pain and all of a sudden you have chest discomfort, at least go to the urgent care to seek medical attention, okay? And from there on, a healthcare provider can determine what's the risk of you actually having a heart attack or not.
Would you mind maybe checking me out real quick with your what's that thing called?
Yeah, stethoscope. Yeah. So that's a good question. Yeah, the reason, because you cannot diagnose a heart attack with a stethoscope.
Oh, you can't? Okay.
You cannot.
Okay, so you got to get an EKG or something else.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Right. And so when you go to the emergency room or the urgent care, they will ask a lot of questions. And these questions are to assess your risk of having a heart attack. Mm. And those are, do you smoke? Do you have diabetes? Do you have hypertension? Do you have any of these risk factors that put you at a different spectrum to have a heart attack? At the same time, they'll do an EKG, they'll do some blood tests, and if they all come back normal, you can go home knowing that you didn't have a heart attack. You may still have the chest pain, right? But knowing that the chest pain is not debilitating,
right,
or that has long-term complications.
Great. Well, hey, I think we're going to wrap up the show here. Is there any last things that you want to leave our audience with?
One point that I would like to emphasize again to the audience is that if you have one of the risk factors, those are high blood pressure, high cholesterol, obesity, diabetes, and risk factors that don't necessarily interfere with your day-to-day activity on your busy schedule, right? Make an effort. Be proactive at going to your regular checkups, right, with your physician so they can assess what's your risk. And from there on, determine what's the best intervention to reduce your risk. Remember again, like going back to the analogy I had mentioned, you rather spend an hour or two changing the oil of your car than spending a whole day waiting for AAA to come and get your car towed, right? So same applies here, okay? You want to make sure your risk is reduced as much as possible, right? And the last thing I would like to emphasize is that if an event does occur to you and you have to be reactive, time is tissue. It is very important to seek medical attention as soon as possible.
Excellent. All right. Well, if somebody would want to come see you directly, where can they find you?
Yeah. So our practice is called My Cardiologist. We are in South Florida. I personally practice in the vicinity of South Miami, Kendall. But we are a very strong team of cardiologists, and just we'll put the link on the bio with the phone.
Yeah, it'll all be in the description below. We're going to have his link as well as mycardiologist.com, where you can check out over 50 healthcare providers in the state of Florida. And also, I would just like to say, you know, comment, like, subscribe, leave a review on this show. If you found value in it yourself, maybe somebody else would find value in it too. So feel free to share it with them. And doctor, thank you again.
Thank you for the invite.
Thank you for tuning in. And make sure you hit subscribe if you haven't already. To learn more about My Cardiologist, please visit us at mycardiologist.com.